This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded, and this always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
It's time for Men and the Dunce. Men and the Dunce.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the fourth and final episode of our Denk Marxist Meme Theory mini-series. I'm Noon, and with me is Zach again. Thank you, Zach, for joining me again for this series.
You bet.
So, in our first episode, I mentioned there are two main components to Marx's like intellectual framework. Do you remember what they are?
Fuck. give me a second here. Wait.
I'll give you a hint. They both have the word materialism in them.
I guess... No, I can't remember.
All right. So the first one was dialectical materialism, and that's what we talked about in the first episode, and you might remember that as it was invented so people don't have to read Hegel all the time. And as you may have noticed, I haven't referred to it again. And in that
the system works.
Exactly. Yeah. In that episode, I said that the other half of his like intellectual framework is called historical materialism. Boom, you got it.
Nailed it. I got there in the end.
It's my favorite Denk Marx theory, and I've been saving it to the end because it kind of relies on all of this other stuff about commodities and labor exploitation, whatever. But also because it's fun and cool, I think. So, yeah. Can you read us out our first meme, please, Zach? And this is a bit of a tricky one. In fact, both of the ones that we've got for this episode are a little too dank. So
they're pretty dank. They're sort of they're definitely not going to translate well to audio format.
Cool.
But I'll give it a shot. Okay, so the first one is a chessboard, and there's a white rook, a white pawn.
The pawn goes first.
And a black knight.
Uh huh.
So the black knight is threatening...
No. The pawn moves first, sorry. Okay, you explain the meme. I'm sorry. We have different jobs in this show. You explain the meme.
It's chess. It's a picture of fucking chess, okay? Okay, so there's a white pawn labeled Overthrow the Dictatorship of the Aristocracy. Near that pawn is a black knight titled The Dictatorship of the Bourgeoisie Creates a New Proletarian Underclass to Exploit the Labor for Profit. And there's a second white piece, There's a second white piece which is labeled "The Rule of the Bourgeois Democrats from the Very First Will Carry Within It the Seeds of Its Own Destruction." Yeah, look, you can do the rest.
Yeah, you bundled through that very adequately. It is a difficult meme to explain. It doesn't have that neat format that many popular memes have. But anyway. So there's a famous line from the Communist Manifesto, which actually the first sentence of the first chapter, and it says, "The history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of class struggle." And I kind of mentioned this last week when I said that all societies are organized around one ruling class who exploit the labor of the other classes. And this ruling class shapes society dramatically, and as Marx says in The German Ideology, "The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas, i.e. the class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The class which has the means of material production at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production, and so that thereby, generally speaking, the ideas of those who lack the means of mental production are subject to it." Now, obviously, this is written in, 1800s German translated badly by nerds, but I think it's a pretty clear point in a lot of ways, right? The people who control society or have the most power in society materially, because they're the most wealthy and they control the government, whatever, they also promulgate their conceptual framework in a way that makes everyone else kind of forced to think of the world in that way. And so one example is schools, obviously, right? So the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, organize schools in a way that teach people to be good workers, right? So up until the Industrial Revolution and the rise of the bourgeoisie as the ruling class, which I'll go into a bit more in a sec, schools were basically institutions for rich people to decide how to spend their time, right? Aristocrats would send their children to universities or like doctoral schools or whatever, they'd learn some science, and then they would spend their family fortune digging up graves and looking at livers or like being a priest or whatever, right? But the schools were definitely not Sounds structured dope. Like an industrial factory as they are now, with like bells and timesheets and discrete activities that need to be completed like semi-mechanistically, and uniforms and bosses and like training wheel wages in the form of report cards and so on. These are all ways of thinking and organizing that teach people to be good workers in a factory. And it's because the bourgeoisie, the ruling class, that we have schools that teach people to operate in that way. Whereas when the aristocrats were the ruling class, educational facilities were about like being like a great Renaissance man or whatever, you know, it was about like making the noble people more noble. But anyway, I just referred to the rise of the bourgeoisie in the Industrial Revolution. And this is really the fundamental point that I want to get across with the idea of historical materialism, which is that the bourgeoisie were not always the ruling class, and that the ideas and social relations that benefit them, like wage labor, parliamentary democracy, taxes, schools, like the nation state, these weren't all obvious facts of nature. They were enforced by the bourgeoisie as they became the ruling class. And to be clear, I don't mean this in sort of a conspiratorial way where people are like, ah, yes, we need to teach the peasants to be workers or whatever. It's just that, like, as those people become more powerful, they organize things in a way that suits them, and that trickles down throughout society. So, as I've said, the basic idea of historical materialism is that the forces of production are always arranged in a way that benefits the ruling class. And that arrangement is called the mode of production. So currently we're living in a capitalist mode of production, which is the sort of mode of production that you have when the bourgeoisie are in charge. Before this was feudalism, which is the mode of production that you have when the aristocracy are the ruling class. Right. And as I read that quote from Marx, which I've been trying to avoid reading too many quotes from dead guys, but he says that in every mode of production contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction. And I want to give an example, sort of briefly run us through the fall of feudalism and the rise of capitalism. All right, so feudalism is the mode of production that happens when the ruling class is the aristocracy. And the fundamental social relations of feudalism are fiefdom and serfdom. So fiefdom basically means that all the land belongs to the king or the queen or the emperor or whatever, and he packages out and lets other people control and administrate sections of it, and those sections are called fiefdoms. So under the king there's a baron, and the barons have big areas, and then below the barons are dukes and earls and whatever, and they have smaller fiefs. Then, so that's the property relation, right, of feudalism. And then there's the labor relation, which is serfdom. And so this is a labor relation between the ruling class, the aristocracy, and the working class, who are the serfs or the peasants. And in this situation, the serfs are basically chattel. They're property, and they're attached to the land that they're on. So whoever the baron is or the duke or whatever that owns that land at that time, they own the trees that are on the land, they own the lakes that are on the land, they own the cows, and they own the humans. And when the baron dies and someone else takes over, or like if that baron gets fired and the king puts a new baron or whatever, the serfs stay in the same place and now belong to the new lord, right? So these two social relations, fiefdom and serfdom, are ways that the ruling class, the aristocracy, figured out suits them really well and helps reinforce their power. And something that I think is really cool is that commodity production basically didn't exist in this era. So this was a couple of weeks ago now, but commodities are goods that are produced primarily for exchange. And the serfs basically didn't do this. They didn't make goods to sell. They grew wheat or raised pigs or whatever, and they grew that wheat to eat, right? It was for them to use as wheat, or the pigs. They ate the pigs or whatever. They weren't being like, oh yeah, if I get six extra pigs, I can sell them for a profit and buy a new shit shovel or whatever, you know. They produce them for the use value, not the exchange value.
Way to stereotype serfs, my God.
Yeah, well, stereotype the aristocracy too, so it's fine. I'm an equal opportunity offender.
Classic.
But the lords also appropriated the surplus value in the form of non-commodities, right? So they would get the wheat from the serfs, but they wouldn't sell it or whatever, or to make profit to invest in more industries like happens in the capitalist mode of production. Those goods were used for things like feeding soldiers, right? They got the wheat from the peasants and then they gave it to the soldiers so they could go to war, or they built castles or whatever, right? So profit motive and profiting and investment, these aren't social relations that benefit the aristocracy. But they do benefit this other so-called middle class who weren't peasants and weren't aristocrats. They were things like merchants or artisans, so like handcrafts people, also professionals like lawyers and doctors. And they were called burghers, which means people of a city, right? Like Hamburg. Ich bin ein Hamburger. No, that's Berlin or whatever. Burger is actually where we get the word bourgeoisie from. It's the French word for the German word, which is burghers. Gotcha. And their power slowly increases over centuries and centuries. Like, they've always existed, these middle classes and the craftsmen and the merchants and so on. They've existed for millennia, but they were slowly, slowly growing their power over centuries until the Industrial Revolution. And I don't want to go into a huge amount of detail about the Industrial Revolution, but suddenly this put a lot more power in the hands of the bourgeoisie because manufacturing became much more efficient, right? And over time, more factories are built, more investments are made, and so on. And so these new money burghers start challenging the aristocracy for power. And this is a very long and drawn-out process, and it's complicated and goes backwards and forwards, and it happens differently in different times and places. But the peasants basically start moving to the cities and getting wage labor jobs, whereas previously they weren't paid for their labor, right? They just grew wheat, they kept some of it, gave some of it to the king. There's no money, there's no wages. But now they're moving to the cities and getting wage labor jobs. And in many situations, this was like enforced violently or with the threat of imprisonment and so on. In England, there was a famous situation called the enclosures of the commons. All right, this process is called proletarianization, and it's the process of turning one working class, the peasants, into a different type of working class, the proletariats. And that was going on because the ruling class was changing, and the ruling class needed a different type of working class to exploit, because the bourgeoisie needed to exploit people through wage labor rather than through serfdom. Just as a side note, the hammer and sickle is the logo of the, like, Socialist Party of Russia, because it was a unifying of the two working classes. The peasants are the sickle and the hammer is the proletariat, right? So it's like both of those together.
Neat.
Anyway, suddenly it's 1850. Karl Marx has been studying capitalism for decades. Feudalism is basically completely dead and gone. And the new technology of the Industrial Revolution is everywhere because it exacerbated the technology exacerbated the contradictions within feudalism, right? The conflict between the profit motive and the interests of the aristocracy. But I wanted to talk about this week. So that's a little bit of historical materialism about a change of one mode of production that contained within itself the seeds of its own destruction and how it then transformed into a new mode of production. But what Marx was really concerned about wasn't the contradictions of feudalism, but the contradictions within capitalism. And so, Zach, could you read us our very final meme for this entire series?
So we've got a big graph. It's going down, mm-hmm. and there's a skeleton doing a sick nose grind down the graph, and the graph is labeled the rate of profit tumble inexorably towards zero, and there's a little bit more text which says it's going to be a bumpy fucking ride. Potentially also useful is the that there's a little uptick in the graph, which is the time between 2008 and 2019, and now we're in the plunging section again. That rate of profit is going down so steeply, you could do a skeleton nose grind on that bad boy.
Hell yeah.
Seems to be the message.
Yeah. I think that little uptick and down again was not making some really deep cut economic reference. I think it was just like they got a picture of a graph and used it. But
it came pre-labeled.
Yeah.
Happens to the best of us.
This is just one contradiction within capitalism that I want to explain, and there are plenty of others, and some of them are like really obvious. We talked a bit about contradiction in the first episode and about how they're productive, right? They're not paradoxes, but these conflicts cause change. And I would really like to strongly recommend a book called A Marxist History of the World by a guy called Neil Faulkner. And it's not very theory dense. Like, it's not like these episodes, it's not like reading Marx. It's literally like a history of the world. It goes through from like before ancient Greece and then through Rome and blah, 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 up to the modern day. And it's just like historical materialism, the book, and talks a lot about different types of contradiction. And I found it really illuminating. But I just want to talk about one particular contradiction within capitalism, which is the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. And this is a type of contradiction of intra-class competition between capitalists. There are lots of other different types, and like an obvious one is that capitalists want to pay workers less and workers want more pay, right? So that's one contradiction that's kind of a bit obvious and that's between different classes. But this is a conflict within the capitalist class. Marx has this idea of the iron law of competition, which is basically that companies always try to make things cheaper than one another. And this is just what, you know, capitalists, the liberal government, are always talking about, like, oh, competition's good for business, good for the economy, good for the consumer. And the way that competition works is that companies to produce good compete with one another to produce goods more efficiently, say by inventing new machines or new organizational structures that let them fire people or produce things more quickly or whatever. So a good example of this, for example, is the Ford production line that, like, previously people were doing like 30 or 40 different jobs and to make a car, and Ford was like, no, each person's just going to do one job 800 times, and it becomes much faster, right? So when these companies get some kind of innovation, right, so either a new machine or a new organizational structure or whatever else, they can use that to profit in two ways. The first way is to keep their prices stable, right, so that they keep the same amount of market share. They sell the same amount of goods for the same price, but it costs them less to produce those goods, right, so they have a higher profit margin for each sale. The other option
makes sense so far.
Yep. The other option is to reduce their prices and thus expand the market share, right? So if someone starts selling iPhones for half price, they end up selling way more iPhones than the people selling them for full price. But
Noon, if everyone keeps on doing that, it seems like we're going to have a problem.
Yes, exactly, right? Because if one company cuts their prices and expands the market share, that innovation then spreads to other companies who then do the same thing, and then everyone's profit rates drop. And so this is a really interesting situation where the individual interests of individual capitalists and individual businesses are against other businesses, but by acting on those interests, they make it worse for everyone. I guess it's technically like a prisoner's dilemma or something like that.
It's like their own personal interests are actually contradictory to the interests of capitalism as a system or capitalism on the whole.
Exactly.
Because, yeah.
And so this is a beautiful example of a contradiction inherent within capitalism that is a seed of its own destruction. Exactly. And so the issue is that in an industry, as this competition happens, prices go down and down and down, and profit margins go down and down and down, theoretically to zero. And I realize we're like, this episode has been the longest by a long margin, so I do want to wrap up soon. But just one quick example is Wikipedia, which basically destroyed the entire encyclopedia industry overnight, which was like an $8 billion a year industry, like literally within 6 months, completely shut down. Maybe a year, 6 months is an exaggeration, but like, and it was because they had innovated this new technology that let people basically create and access encyclopedias for free. And so it destroyed this entire industry. And that's one small example, but the same thing is going to happen with plenty of other goods. And we see it with microchips getting cheaper per processing power and all sorts of other things. And at some point, if this cycle continues, it will no longer be profitable for capitalists to produce goods for sale, right? The rate of profit will become zero. And the question is, what will happen then? Will capitalism be able to survive this situation where profit no longer exists? And it seems like to me,
the capitalist singularity.
Exactly. And this particular contradiction is one that comes up a lot in left accelerationist circles. Specifically, there's this like group of theorists called post-capitalists who focus on this fall of the rate of profit. And I don't necessarily fully agree that like this is the contradiction that's going to deal the death blow to capitalism, but it could. I just wanted to explain one particular contradiction that we're seeing play out right now before our very eyes. And I just wanted to end on a quote from a song that I'm trying to learn on guitar. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, it was a short quote. I thought about doing the whole verse, but yeah.
Thanks for taking us through those memes, Noon.
No worries, thank you for listening to my rambles.
A little bit on a bit of Marxist theory here and there, little bits and pieces. I hope you listeners got a little something out of it and enjoyed this bit of a diversion from our normal kind of content. Do you like this? Do you want more of it? Do you hate it? Should we do the opposite? Let us know.
Please do. Yeah.
Yeah, we want to know. And like, we're going to have to set a new goal for ourselves because, you know, we did all these as a kind of like, when we hit 50 patrons, we'll do this bonus content. So we'll need to set a goal for 75 or something. And what are we going to do when we hit that? You know,
it should be something that
people actually want to hear. So let us know. All
right.
I think that probably about does it for the Noon and this season of Noon and the Dunce. Perhaps we shall return in season two. Keep on skeleton nose grinding your way towards the capitalist singularity, dudes. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Bye.